Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning and welcome to Africa Link on this Tuesday, the 5th of April. I'm Eunice Wanjiro in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, mounting pressure on South Africa's President Jacob Zuma to step down ahead of a motion in Parliament to impeach him.
I think he should be removed. His removal is long overdue.
I think he should step down.
Also, his cabinet at large must also step down.
The Panama Papers scandal reveals the names of relatives of African leaders, but is the continent responding?
Africa has been talking about this. If you go on Facebook and even on the website of the institution that released this leaked document, that's the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, you'd find a lot of responses there.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
South Africa's parliament will today debate a motion to impeach President Jacob Zuma. This comes after the Constitutional Court ruled that the president violated the constitution by failing to act on the findings of the public protector over the multi-million rand Nkandla scandal. Calls for Zuma to step down or for him to be impeached have grown louder over the past few days. But the ruling ANC, which held another emergency meeting yesterday, is deeply divided. Subri Govinda reports.
The ruling ANC in South Africa, of which President Jacob Zuma is the national leader, is deeply divided over what his political future should be. While some factions are still firmly in support of Zuma and believe he should continue in office, there are a significant number of senior figures within the ANC, alliance partners, veteran struggle stalwarts, members of civil society, and other organizations who want to see him resign immediately. They are hoping that Zuma will step down gracefully before the impeachment debate takes place on Tuesday. 86-year-old Swami Gowden is a veteran struggle stalwart who has been an official of the ANC and South African Communist Party since his early teens. He was listed and restricted by the former apartheid regime for 25 years during the early burly years of the freedom struggles. He says Zuma should go.
My personal view is he should regard the will of the people. The will of the people now is for him to honorably step down and give others a break so that there wouldn't be continuous struggle going on among the ANC, opposition party and others.
There is also disenchantment with Zuma among young South Africans. These students I spoke to at the Durban University of Technology were in no doubt that the career of the South African president was now finished.
I think he should be removed. His removal is long overdue. He has done a lot to drag this country down. So I think now it's time for him to give somebody else a chance because he's not a good president and he's not capable of leading this country forward.
Nkandla thing has brought the lot of confusion in the parliament. So I think he should step down.
He should step down. He has done a lot of things by not following the constitution of our country. Also, his cabinet at large must also step down because all of those ANC members are in those chairs at the parliament. They are all corrupts. I think they should change the system of this country, not just stepping Zuma down. If Zuma steps down, they will elect another member who will do as Zuma always pleases.
In a surprise move, the South African Defence Union has also joined the loud calls for Zuma's office to be terminated. The union, which represents members of the country's armed forces, said Zuma could no longer be a fit and proper commander-in-chief. Piki Grief is the national secretary of the 16,000-strong Defence Union.
We are, in principle, supporting any lawful means that are aimed at clearing up this crisis and this anomaly. And the only way to clear it up is by exerting pressure so that this person can be, the president can be lawfully removed.
However, analysts are saying that Zuma is likely to be president for some time to come. Judith February, a political analyst based in Cape Town, says the ruling ANC is in no hurry to oust its president.
We also note that the ANC is deeply, deeply divided. They are unable to recall the president. But this is no country for a recall. As we've said all along, the unraveling of President Zuma is going to take a while yet.
There's no doubt there will be another round of heated debate in Parliament today between some members of the ruling ANC and the opposition leaders over Zuma's future. It remains to be seen how the ANC intends to resolve this crisis.
Subri Govinda reporting. To follow up on the fallout from the court ruling last week that President Jacob Zuma flouted the constitution, I spoke to Ralph Matega, an independent political analyst based in Johannesburg. I first wanted to find out whether Zuma was likely to survive any bid to have him removed, having, as he did, a strong grip on parliament.
Irrespective of how angry the opposition parties are, for a motion of no confidence to be passed, mathematically, they need the support of the ANC on that. And I do not see a chance where the ANC agrees to remove their own party, their president, through a motion that has been tabled by the opposition parties. It is highly unlikely that the ANC would concede to that. The reality is that if the ANC wanted to remove him, they could do it within their own internal structures by asking him to resign before it reaches parliament and embarrasses the party in the public.
But some anti-apartheid activists, as well as five top members of South Africa's ruling ANC, are calling on Jacob Zuma to step down. But will he succumb to this mounting pressure?
The voices that we hear, of course, they have increased those voices that he should resign. But I don't think it makes any difference. All it does is that it raises the moral basis of his leadership, which is something that I don't think he's very much worried about since he has become the president. For him, the most important thing is support within the ANC, at least from members who matter within the party. Those are members of the national executive and branches within the party. As long as those structures support him, it doesn't matter what the former stalwarts are saying about him.
But is this support for Zuma within the ANC starting to crumble?
Certainly it's becoming weaker. I mean, it is becoming uncomfortable for people to readily publicly defend him. But I wouldn't say it's falling apart fast. There are divisions within the party with those who need him to go, but those divisions have been there. And the question is whether those divisions, some of those who need him to go, will they be able to use the recent incidents, including the court ruling against him, to get rid of him? They have not been able to do so on other instances, other scandals that he have been associated with him in the past. And it remains to be seen as to whether now are they in a position to use the recent court ruling that raises concerns about the president's adherence to the constitution to actually argue for his removal. It is not going to be an easy project. It will require a lot of political mobilization within the party.
I was speaking to Ralph Matega, independent political analyst in Johannesburg.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Governments across the world began investigating possible financial wrongdoing by the rich and powerful on Monday following a leak of documents from a Panamanian law firm, Mossack Fonseca, which allegedly showed how clients avoided tax or laundered money. The leaked documents involve a number of figures from friends of Russian President Vladimir Putin to relatives of the prime ministers of Britain, Iceland and Pakistan, as well as the president of Ukraine. Relatives of African leaders have also been seen in the Panama Papers. The documents were first obtained by German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, led by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and involving more than 100 publications from nearly 80 countries. Earlier on, I spoke to my colleague Abubakar Jallo and wanted to find out who are the African elites mentioned in these leaked documents.
We actually have quite a lot, but the most prominent one that I mentioned in this leaked Panama paper is the nephew of South Africa's President Jacob Zuma, involved in a shady deal in the DR Congo. And there's also Kalpana Rawal, who is Kenya's Deputy Chief Justice, also involved in some business activities also in the UK. Ghana's former president, John Agyekum Kufo, his son was also involved, was also mentioned in this leaked document. And there's also the widow of Guinea's former president, Mamadi Toure. She was also involved in some of the information published. There's also Muniru Majid, personal secretary to King of Morocco, Morocco's King, Mohammed VI. There's also José Mario Botelho de Vasconcelos, who is the oil minister of Angola. We also have Ian Kirby, current head of the highest court in Botswana. And there's also the twin sister of President of the DR Congo, Joseph Kabila. And lastly but not least, on our list of names from Africa, we also have Kojo Annan, the son of former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
You've mentioned the nephew of South African President Jacob Zuma, but is this disclosure likely to harm the president because the National Assembly is going to be debating his impeachment later today?
Currently, what we've seen is that the opposition in South Africa, they are using every possible means as a tool against President Zuma in order to oust him. And I think this is definitely going to be an important tool for them as well. This is an additional information that they will be using in their case against President Zuma.
And how have African governments in general been responding to the release of the Panama Papers?
We haven't seen much response yet from African leaders, but Africa has been talking about this. If you go on Facebook and even on the website of the institution that released this leaked document, that's the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, you'd find a lot of responses there. Most of them are as well Africans who, some say they are surprised, others say, well, this is just a vindication of what the people are saying, that most African leaders and top figures are also very corrupt.
I was speaking to my colleague Abubakar Jallo. It is nevertheless important to note that the persons mentioned in the documents are not necessarily guilty of any wrongdoing unless proven so in a court of law.
Africa on the move.
When you think of the economy in Nigeria, the first thing that will come to your mind is oil. Since it was discovered in the 1960s, there has been little interest in other sectors like agriculture. Before the discovery of oil, Nigeria exported more coffee to the outside world than any other country, but it can hardly produce large quantities anymore. A Kenyan now wants to change that. She wants to interest Nigerians with their coffee taste and revive the entire coffee sector. This report for Africa on the Move by Adrian Krish is being presented to you by Joanne Okitoi.
Freshly ground and served, Kaldi Coffee Shop is famous in Lagos, Nigeria's commercial capital. A group of visitors come in to taste various coffee varieties from Africa.
I think I prefer the Nigerian one. It's very ground nuttish.
I felt it when I took it, and the smell just came from my nose down to my lungs, and the liquid down to the... It gave me, you know, thrill.
Coffee beans made in Nigeria is Nasra Ali's idea. Originally, her family comes from Somalia, but she grew up in Kenya, a coffee-producing country. Nasra studied medicine, but when she moved to Nigeria with her husband, she seldom saw coffee shops.
From a very young age, I've been very passionate about coffee. Besides drinking it, I've always been very curious. And one of the things that I noticed mostly was that I was not able to get fresh coffee, having grown up with the fresh coffee completely accessible to me. It was something that I really missed dearly when I came to Nigeria.
She still imports the coffee beans, but in the long term, she wants to start up her own brand of Nigerian coffee. Nigeria's eastern region has the best conditions for growing coffee, as Nasra has found out. This means she has to fly to the region, a flight that takes her 3 hours and then 10 hours by car. In the state of Taraba is where her company wants to establish a cooperative and work with local farmers. Coffee growers here don't have sufficient knowledge on how to produce good coffee.
But it is not just the coffee you have now. It has to be good coffee. And to get the good coffee, we have to teach you, and you as the farmers have to be willing to do the work. You have to do the work. So it's not the same. You cannot be drying it outside. You cannot be intercropping. You cannot just leave your crop growing very long. No, you have to be a very serious coffee farmer.
The coffee beans that Nasra Ali is satisfied with, she returns them back to Lagos. It is an investment for the future, she says. Nigeria has a population of more than 180 million people. And because of the growing middle class, the demand for coffee is highly anticipated.
Right now, all the coffee that is in Nigeria is imported. And we are the first roastery that has been set up, and we're very proud of that. We have very strong machinery and partners, and we are working quite well.
However, the biggest challenge is the long-term part of it. In Nigeria, there is hardly a coffee culture. Even in good hotels, there's often only instant coffee. With training and seminars, Ali wants to attract Nigerians to their coffee and its good taste.
That report was written by Adrian Krish. Nigeria's army has announced the arrest of Khalid al-Barnawi, the leader of Islamist militant group Ansaru. Ansaru is a splinter faction of Boko Haram that has been accused of kidnapping and killing Westerners. In 2012, the U.S. State Department named Khalid al-Barnawi one of three Nigerian militants blacklisted for ties to Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Originally named Usman Umar Abu Bakr, al-Barnawi was arrested in the central city of Lokoja on Friday. But how did he come to be arrested? I put this question to Ryan Cummings, an African security and political analyst.
Well, again, lots of speculation regarding who Khalid al-Barnawi is, what his role is within Boko Haram, if he is indeed affiliated at all to Boko Haram, and whether an individual that has been apprehended by Nigeria's security forces is indeed one of the senior members of the Boko Haram so-called Shura Council, or their highest decision-making body. In terms of the military communique, it seems that they've been tracking al-Barnawi for quite a significant while, and then used this opportunity when he was in Kogi State in the capital Lokoja to basically ambush and subsequently arrest him.
Okay, so what impact is his arrest likely to have on Ansaru and Boko Haram militant groups?
Well, it's very difficult to say because, as I mentioned, we still don't quite know exactly what al-Barnawi's positioning was within Boko Haram, who have obviously assumed the moniker of Islamic State in West Africa province. There were suggestions that al-Barnawi was part of an offshoot of Boko Haram known as Ansaru that broke away from the group in early 2012, citing that Boko Haram was discriminately targeting Muslims in acts of violence, and it was something that the Ansaru leadership at the time did not agree with. And there were also suggestions that Ansaru was going to become so-called Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb's proxy within Nigeria. And this is specifically amid claims that Khalid al-Barnawi had very close ties to Mokhtar al-Mokhtar, who is, you know, one of the more senior figures in the AKIM leadership. But where al-Barnawi eventually falls within Boko Haram's leadership is very difficult to say. He's not appeared in any of the group's videos. They haven't alluded to al-Barnawi in any of the communiques that they've released. The focus has always been on Abu Bakr Shekau. So again, it's very difficult to say as to what the impact would be on Boko Haram, given that we don't even know what al-Barnawi's position was in the movement itself.
And how significant is this arrest in the struggle to defeat Boko Haram?
Well, it could be a significant arrest. If al-Barnawi is part of the Shura Council, if he does assume a top leadership position within the group, obviously apprehending such leaders, it blows a so-called almost logistical blow to Boko Haram, because he may have been involved in some high-level operational and logistical planning for the group and could have brought various expertise to the organization. And if it is true that al-Barnawi does have strong linkages to networks, you know, not only within Nigeria, but also across the Sahel, then there could significantly be a major blow that has been dealt to Boko Haram. Another important thing is if we do apprehend a senior militant commander in custody, as opposed to killing him on the battlefield, you are also able to derive quite a significant amount of intelligence from him. So obviously this in itself could be very advantageous to the Nigerian government.
Do we know of any attacks that Ansaru has claimed responsibility for?
Yes, we do. There's been a spate of kidnappings we saw in January 2012. When the group announced its formation in January 2012, we saw the kidnapping of a German national in the city of Kano. This wasn't directly claimed by Ansaru, but it believes that the group was behind the attack. Later on, however, there were two separate kidnappings again in northern Nigeria. One of this occurred in Wini, in Katsina State. A French national was taken hostage in this incident. And then there was another kidnapping in the town of Jamaara in the north of Bauchi State. And both of these attacks and these kidnappings were claimed by Ansaru.
Ryan Cummings, an African and security political analyst.
Making a difference.
Health researchers and the Malawi government have adopted what they call one of the best and quickest ways of testing for HIV. The method enables couples to test for the virus in the privacy of their homes without the involvement of health officials. This means they do not necessarily need to travel long distances to undergo testing or counseling at health facilities. At the moment, the HIV/AIDS prevalence in Malawi is 10%. George Muhango reports from Blantyre.
It is called OraQuick. The test kit looks like a pregnancy test. And like a pregnancy test, it's designed to give fast results. After unwrapping the kit, you just swab your upper and lower gums and stick the cap back and wait for 20 minutes. If there is one line showing, it means that you are HIV negative. Two lines mean that you are HIV positive. It is simple, private, and the company's website says it is over 90% accurate. The whole kit usually costs around $60. But in Malawi, researchers from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the Malawi Liverpool Wellcome Trust and College of Medicine have been training individuals and providing OraQuick kits free of charge. To date, more than 8,000 tests have been conducted. Roderick Sambakusi works as a counselor with the program. He says the system saves time and it is easier to use.
There's a lot happening in the self-testing, and we are happy the way it's going. We have the support of the local leaders, the churches, and all the communities in the areas where we're working. So we think it is worth pursuing.
Despite many HIV and AIDS awareness campaigns and the government offering HIV testing and counseling in antenatal care clinics, many people in Malawi remain reluctant to go for HIV tests as they fear becoming stigmatized. As a result, many HIV-infected women give birth in health facilities without knowing whether they are infected. 26-year-old Joshua Mare learned about his wife's infection the hard way after she got tested when she was due for delivery.
I felt betrayed because when she was due for delivery, doctors recommended a test. My wife was found positive. This forced me to do a test as well, and doctors certified my negative status. I felt deceived by my wife, especially when she delivered a premature baby and died 5 days later.
Out of 14 million Malawians, 2 million people are living with the HIV and AIDS virus. Masuzio Amos is a mother of two. She lives in Blantyre and has used the mouth swab program. She says the OraQuick HIV test is the best weapon in the fight against HIV and AIDS.
As a woman, I need privacy. I have done self-testing many times and nobody knows our status. Most people don't want health personnel to know their status. Even just having tested in health facility, the perception of people is that you are promiscuous. This makes it difficult for one to work in a health clinic just to be tested.
Specialists, however, warn that it is important for people to act on the results. The OraQuick mouth swabs are well designed and easy to use, but any positive result must be confirmed in a health clinic by a finger prick blood test.
George Muhango in Malawi. And before we leave you, here's a reminder of the main stories that we have been covering for you over the last 25 minutes. South Africa's parliament will debate a motion to impeach President Jacob Zuma amid growing calls for him to step down. Relatives of African leaders find their names in Panama Papers. And the military in Nigeria announced the arrest of the leader of Islamist militant group Ansaru. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Please remember that we welcome your comments on our programs about what you've heard and or what you would like to hear. You can send a text message to country code 49160957595510, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. From me, Eunice Njiro, have a great day.